The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Lillis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. And here's round one, which tries to test their vocabularies. 2 marks if they can give me the meaning of the following words. We begin with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is a victorine? V-I-C-T-O-R-I-N-E. Victorine.
Victorine. Victorine. I wear you.
Yes, you do.
A tippet.
Yes, what kind of tippet?
Fur?
Yes.
Well, I don't know, I mean fur.
That's good enough,
just
any problem with it.
Enough.
Named after?
Victor.
No.
Ria. Ria.
Yes, Ria. Probably named after Queen Victoria. A woman's fur tippet. 2 marks. Well done. From about 1850. Dennis Norton. The meaning of the word interlard. I-N-T-E-R-L-A-R-D. Interlard.
Inter means to bury. Lard is a cooking fat. To bury cooking fat. Now that's a custom that's dying out. Because it doesn't mean anything to do with that. You'd say, since appearing on My Word for the last 18 years, one interlards one's speech with literary references.
Yes. Meaning?
Well, you sort of sprinkle them into the speech as you apparently do. You sprinkle cooking fat? I don't know. I have a woman at home who does cooking for me and bears children and all that sort of thing. I don't know what you do with cooking fat, but presumably it's something to do with cooking the way you use
fold it in. I've never been able to understand.
That's right. You fold it into your speech.
That's it. You mix it up with. And as Dennis quite rightly says, it's people who try to sound more impressive than they have any right to by using big words or foreign words and mixing them up with what they're saying otherwise. 2 marks. Nancy Spain, what is a quant? Q-U-A-N-T.
It's a pole, Jack, that you push along the river the boat with. Very tall pole.
Yes.
Frank Muir's great at it.
Well, how is it different from a punting pole?
Well, an ordinary punting pole has got a sort of little brass hook on the bottom.
Yes, then.
And
it's got something quite else,
like a wheel-shaped bit at the bottom.
That's quite right, because you're
pressing into the mud.
You're punting in East Anglia, which is a very muddy section of the country, and you need a wooden disc at the end of your punting pole.
Yes,
otherwise it goes straight into the mud and you go out of the boat. Frank Muir, what is tautology? T-A-U-T-O. L-O-G-Y, tautology.
It's a very literary word, this.
Yes.
And I myself personally think it's the use of more than one word to exactly, precisely, to describe something where one word would do absolutely, solely on its own.
Absolutely right. That's a beautiful example of a whole series of tautological statements by Frank Muir, and it does. It means needlessly repeating something which could be said in much fewer words. 2 marks it is. That's the end of the round one. But before we start round two, what I do is to give each team a quotation for them to write down. And I want the two women members of the team to study their quotations, and at the end of the programme I shall ask them where those quotations come from. And now, Dillis, and Frank Muir listening, your quotation is, Britons never, never, never will be slaves. And Nancy Spain, with Dennis Norton, yours is your journey really necessary? And then at the end of the programme, I ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas how these words came to be spoken or written, and I don't want any of these answers just yet. And so round two. For 2 marks, of whom and by whom were the following words said? Lewis Powell. Though more than half the world was his, he died without a rood his own, and borrowed from his enemies 6 feet of ground to lie upon.
He's a poor man.
Somebody who conquered half the world and died in exile.
Yes.
Yes.
Quite right.
Napoleon.
Yes, Napoleon. It was written of Napoleon. By whom?
Wait a minute now. It was written of Napoleon by somebody in English.
Yes.
Cooper.
Later than that. I'm going to give you one out of two. It was written of Napoleon by Thackeray in the Chronicles of the Drum.
What initial?
William Makepeace.
Oh.
Dennis Norden. I have not wasted my life trifling with literary fools in taverns as he did when he should have been shaking England with the thunder of his spirit.
With literary fools in taverns.
Yes, or coffee bars, if you like.
Johnson, if it was coffee bars.
Yes.
And that was said by... Was it said by Shaw?
Said by Shaw, or...
of Dr. Johnson in a coffee house.
That's quite right. G.B. Shaw in Parents and Children talking about Sam Johnson. Nancy Spain, yours is much tougher.
Thank you.
Coarse-bred son of a livery stable keeper. Apprentice to an apothecary.
Keats was...
Yes, come on.
It said of Keats.
Yes, it said of Keats.
By this man whose name we never can remember, who wrote this very nasty attack.
Now, you've got the chap right, and I don't think you're likely to get it. It's rather unexpected, this. That's why I said it was hard. I'm going to give it one, Nancy.
That's very nice.
It's said about Keats by the poet Yeats in a poem called Ego Dominus Tuus. Now, Frank Miller. From his poetry, they drew a system of ethics compounded of misanthropy and voluptuousness, a system in which the two great commandments were to hate your neighbour and to love your neighbour's wife. He wrote about a Spaniard.
Is it Nancy's boyfriend?
Yes.
Lord Byron?
Yes, said about Lord Byron by...
By almost everybody at the time. It was literally tittle-tattle in the coffee houses.
The chap I always get mixed up quite wrongly with Thackeray, if that's any help.
But you get everybody mixed up with Thackeray.
Yes, you do.
That's
quite true, that is.
Longfellow.
No, I think one out of two. You've crept home in the last moment. It is.
Yes,
you're quite right.
Two marks.
It was said of Lord Byron's work by Lord Macaulay in his literary essays, as was a review of Moore's Life of Lord Byron. Well, the next round is about verse and poetry. I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it, giving the next line or two. Two marks if they complete it reasonably well, and two more for saying where it comes from. Phyllis Powell, I cannot see what flowers are at my feet, nor what soft incense hangs upon the boughs.
You tell me the bit I know.
That's
but in embalmed darkness, guess each sweet, wherewith the seasonable month endows, the grass, the fruit tree, and the thicket wild.
That's absolutely right, except you put the thicket and the fruit tree the wrong way around. But who and
Keats.
What? Keats.
Ode to a nightingale.
Quite right. Keats, Ode to a Nightingale, and four marks to Dillis Powell.
Well done, Gail.
Well
done.
Well done.
Keep on like that.
Yes.
Dennis Norden. In his chamber, weak and dying, while the Norman Baron lay.
This is not Ode to a Nightingale.
No.
Hard mark? No.
No, not even La Belle Dame sans merci. No help.
It's doggerel.
Yes, pretty doggerel. In his chamber, weak and dying, while the Norman Baron lay.
Come and see the seagulls flying half a crown around the bay. Well, that's what it's that sort of poem.
It's that sort of poem, yes.
In his chambers, weak and dying, something the Norman Baron lay. Even though I'm madly trying, who wrote this, I cannot say.
Have a shot at the author. I can't...
I would like to have a shot.
Well, you have in fact said it, you see. I was trying to help you.
Doggerel.
Who it was, I cannot say.
Seagull.
Anon.
Anon.
Right. It's written by Anon.
I'm going to give you rather, I think, generously, two marks for Anon. Nobody knows who wrote this. It's called A Strike Among the Poets, written in 19th century. It goes like this. In his chamber, weak and dying, while the Norman Baron lay, loud without, his men were crying, shorter hours and better pay. And Nancy, yours is this. The world is too much with us, late and soon.
I knew the next
Wordsworth.
Yes.
It's the sonnet Getting and Spending We Laid Waste
Our Powers.
Our Powers.
Yes, that's good enough. Little we see in nature that is ours, we have given our hearts away a sordid boon. It's miscellaneous sonnets by words that the world is too much with us. Thank God. Oh, Susanna, don't you cry for me.
Because I'm off to Alabama with my banjo on my knee. I play the banjo better now. It's Stephen Makepeace Foster.
I wish it were. No, the accurate quotation is this. Oh, Susanna, don't you cry for me. I've come from Alabama with my banjo on my knee. Do you remember where it was first sung?
In America.
2½. Oh. It was first sung at Andrew's Eagle Ice Cream Saloon.
Of course it was.
Yes.
Yeah.
In Pittsburgh. 2½ marks, I think, after all there. And so the next round, which is origins and derivations of phrases. And these are expressions which are in fairly common use. I want to know what they mean and how they started. To this power, to ride roughshod over someone.
It means to be rather bullying somebody.
Yes.
And sort of crack down on what they say.
Yes.
And it comes from taking a horse without any shoes on and riding it over somebody.
Not quite.
Is there anything to do with a horse?
Yes, oh yes,
it is.
Yes.
Well, not sort of not the right kind of shoes on.
Sort of pumps.
Yes. Stiletto heels. Yes.
Mm. No, ride roughshod.
No, it's not. It isn't like pumps. It's darn sight more like climbing boots. The point is that a horse that is roughshod has the nail heads projecting through the shoe instead of sort of properly fined down,
like cricket
so that it's smooth. And any horse that walked, ran, or jumped over you, roughshod, meant that you not only had the weight of the horse, but you had the projections of the nails too. That must have been very nasty indeed.
I think that's sick.
And figuratively, it means showing a callous lack of consideration for somebody else. 3 out of 4, I think. Dennis Norton, to steal a march.
Well, that means to gain a kind of unexpected advantage over somebody.
And from?
Well, yes, it was with the time of the barons, when the calendar was introduced, and they told the peasants, they took March completely out of the calendar, so the peasants believed there were only 11 months in the year, and they paid their taxes, instead of paying them on the 1st of April, they paid them on the 28th of February. thus, the barons had an unfair advantage. Which went on right from the repeal of the Corn Laws and Lord Shaftesbury's Factories Act.
Give us back our 11 months. No, it won't do. Mm-hmm. It's a jolly nice story though, Dennis. It means now to take an advantage over somebody by cunning and take them by surprise by doing so. But it was in the days when it depended very much how you marched and how fast you marched. And an enemy might be lulled into false security by thinking you were 2 or 3 marches away, and if you did an unexpected march on him with your arm, you caught up with him, or confronted him, or got to the place he wanted to get to before him, before he expected it, and that was stealing a march, a stolen, unexpected march. Nancy Speck, what's the present-day meaning of the term deadline, and how did it start?
Well, if you have to write a story by the day before yesterday, that is known as a deadline.
I don't want it good, I want it Tuesday.
Exactly that.
And
how did it start?
Well, the thing is, you know, once the line is passed, it's dead, you know.
You don't know, Nancy. It's the line or time nowadays beyond which you mustn't go in submitting a bit of work or making a contract or something like that. But originally it was a real deadline. It was in United States prisons, and the authorities used to paint a line across the exercise yards where the prisoners were exercising, and if you did cross that line, they shot you. They shot you dead. Simple as all that.
Yeah.
All right, Frank Muir. What do you understand by the term log rolling?
Vaguely political.
Yes.
Doesn't it mean that I'll go along with you with the understanding, the tacit understanding that you will eventually go along with me.
Yes, that's it. It is, yes. And how does it start?
Well, they're clearing.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I'll help you. Ah, yes. The Pilgrim Fathers, New England.
Yes, that's it.
Wooded. Imagine, lots of woods. They had to build their cabins, but where could they build them? Well, there's trees in the way. When you've got a next door neighbour called the woods, and you can't see the woods for the trees, you have to cut the trees away, you see. And they say, you help me cut these trees away and roll them, and I'll help you. Hence this every day, every other day phrase, log rolling.
Absolutely right.
Or not.
Now we come to the last round, and we go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier on in the programme. For 2 marks, Dillis, can you give me the origin of your quotation, which was, Britons never, never, never will be slaves?
Well, that's Rule Britannia.
By?
Thompson.
Thompson. Quite right. 2 marks. Nancy Spade, I want the origin of your quotation, and that was, is your journey really necessary?
Well, this was on all those posters, Jack, from 1939, 40, 41, 42, and so on.
Yes.
And I suppose the origin was some happy advertising agent whose firm had been paid a large sum of money by the then government. And probably the decision was actually taken at one of those really awful board meetings where somebody says, now what are we going to put on these posters to stop them? I mean, travelling.
Dig for victory.
Yeah. And no. They waited, they couldn't think what to put on the poster, and one of those office boys came in with a white face and red hair, and they said, what would you say to these people if you didn't want them to travel? And the office boy said, is your journey really necessary?
Well, that's a beautiful and entrancing story. I'm going to give Nancy 2 marks for it. And now I ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations really came into being.
Right.
And on this occasion, no, wait a bit. This occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer amount of applause from you, the audience here in the studio.
Now. Frank. Right, go.
Britons never, never, never go. Will be slaves.
Go. Britons never, never. Right. I'm a fairly cosmopolitan sort of chap, you know. I mean, I'm very interested in other nations, and I trust other nations are very interested in me. But I worry sometimes, you know. And one of the things I worry about is whether this country of ours, where are we? Oh, Britain. Great, great Britain, Albion, isn't coming too much under the influence of other countries. Take the United States of America. Well, no, not literally, but just sort of examine them. You see, they have given us what? They have given us the automatic eating machine, the automat. Instead of having waitress service in a restaurant, the little flaps and things like a huge wardrobe that you approach with a tray and lifted things out. I went into one of those, terribly unnerving, and I put my tray down, and I got a piece of fish out of a cupboard thing, and I was reaching for the tomato sauce, and I unscrewed the tomato sauce from another cupboard, and I shook it vigorously, and it had shaken right over a lady's blancmange. Apparently this thing I put my tray down on was actually a moving platform, and my tray of fish was now about 8 feet long. And by the time I'd explained to the lady what my tomato sauce was doing on her de blanche, I then had to run up there. And I'd lost my tray entirely because there was a sort of right-angle bend in this arrangement. And I ended up with 4 lemon curd tarts, which I don't eat, and a handful of drinking straws, which I chewed rather miserably. And that was my experience of automatic. Now, what would we get from Italy? I mean, you've seen Italian films. They all talk with terrific gestures of the arms. Well, I was thinking about this, you know. This is what we'll be doing. You know where you talk most? at a cocktail party. Imagine everybody talking with great gestures of the arm, holding a glass of gin. This gin will be sluicing through the air. Cocktail parties in England would be like Brighton Front, midwinter in a force gale, spew gin, you know. And think of those cocktail sticks. You know, there's no sharper piece of wood in the world than a cocktail stick, loaded with a heavy cherry. It'll be King Harold at Hastings all over again. I am a very worried man. And then Yugoslavia. You see, the Yugoslavia hire purchase system. It's all run by the government, and if you pay for your television set in less than 2 years, you get a small brass medal. And if you take longer than 2 years, you get shot. You see, I don't think this is a good thing. You know, because if anybody should be shot in television, surely it shouldn't be the viewer, for one thing. And I think this would be a terribly bad thing. I mean, so much. I mean, Britain is a land of never, never now. And I mean, if you're going to get shot, if you get overpaid, well, life is going to be pretty crisp, isn't it? And I think it may do for the Slavs, but not for here. So I want you, after this programme is over, to rise with me in a body, and we're all going to say, shout at the top of our voices, "Rule Britannia, although Britannia starves, Britons never, never, never shall be Slavs."
And so, to Dennis Norton, and his quotation was, "Is your journey really necessary?"
Old wartime saying. This takes me back to wartime. I was with the 31st Commando Ablutions and Maintenance Unit. We were a specially trained mob, 5 of us. Actually, I was in charge because I was the only one who had a field dressing. And we were being trained to be dropped onto enemy territory, capture German generals and bring them back. And we were given an extensive course of training, including manoeuvres and dummy exercises. And part of the training was to take a real general and try and run him across England without being spotted. For this purpose, they gave us this general, who was a foreign general. He was actually a retired French general. And we were given him at Catterick and told to get him down to Aldershot without being captured. And they alerted the whole of the Home Forces to be looking for us. Well, it was some job. They landed us in this field and they said, "Right, there's your general. We're going to count to 100 with our eyes closed, and then we're going to open them and come after you." So we ran like mad for 5 hours with this general, and then paused, because we saw that was no good. He was 82. I should have mentioned that. He was having tremendous difficulty keeping up. So I said, "All right, Frobisher, you take him by the arms. O'Malley, you take him by the legs, and we'll run with the General for a while." So we ran for 2.5 hours, and I noticed that O'Malley hadn't heard my order. Frobisher had him by the legs. He was being taken across the country rather like people sometimes pull a lawnmower. So we stopped again, and we picked the bits of bramble and earth off him. He was in fine spirits, kept on saying, "Il ne passera pas." He had the wrong war or something, but he was a very keen old chap. And we thought, well, we'll never get him down to Aldershot at this rate. The thing to do is to get some transport. Put him in some transport. And evade capture, of course. So we put him in a hollow tree trunk and reconnoitred. And I saw a military hospital for Indian soldiers. As you know, we had quite a lot over here during the war. We thought, now, if we can get some transport from here, we have a chance of getting our general down to Aldershot without being spotted. So I obtained an ambulance by a very clever subterfuge. I went to the CEO of the camp and I said, "I bet if I asked you for an ambulance, you'd think it was a very clever subterfuge. See, I bet I wouldn't. We went out with the ambulance, and inside we found three Indian orderly, medical orderlies' uniforms, and a sari belonging to an Indian nurse. So we shared the medical orderlies' uniforms among us, and we dressed the general in a sari. And he looked terribly good. He looked just like something from The Rains Came. You know, he like a very beautiful Indian nurse, if you sort of shut your eyes, half closed, you know, which you have to do in the Indian sun, so that's all right. And we put him in the ambulance, and it very nearly came off. We travelled a full, 430 yards, I think it was, before we were intercepted by a roadblock which the CO of the hospital had put up, because he'd been thinking about this subterfuge and decided it was a subterfuge. And we were interrogated, taken to the interrogation room, and he was taken off by a rather burly ATS officer, the general in the sari. We were a little bit worried because she was bound to investigate to one extent or another, and we sat there, crouched there, and finally we got this message from the head of the interrogation department, which said, "Is your journey really necessary?" And we thought we'd got away with it until O'Malley, who was very quick at these things, said, no, we haven't got away with it, reread it again. Actually, what it did read was, "Is your general in nurse's sari?"
Well, I don't know, I find that rather hard to decide. I think by a short round, as it were, Frank Muir just wins. And that brings us to a final score in which Frank Muir and Dilys Powell win by 2 marks from Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden. It also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longman. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶